What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Jeff Booth is the author of the new book titled The Price of Tomorrow: Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. In this conversation, we discuss the difference between inflation and deflation, why technology is inherently deflationary, how easy credit has led to a massive asset bubble, why the world will need to move to a deflationary economy, and how Jeff is currently thinking about the economic crisis we are facing. I really enjoyed this conversation, and Jeff did a great job. Before I get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our two sponsors. The first is Crypto.com. They're a pioneering payment and cryptocurrency platform that seeks to accelerate the world's transition to cryptocurrency. They have a vision to put cryptocurrency in every wallet, which is frankly why we're all here. The Crypto.com app offers a full range of financial products with competitive pricing, well-designed user experience, and high security. It's the best place to buy, sell, and pay with crypto. These guys have been longtime supporters of Off the Chain, and they keep launching new product after new product. So do yourself a favor and go to Crypto.com to check them out. Again, Crypto.com. Great URL, great products. Crypto.com, the place where mass adoption is occurring. Our second sponsor is Ledger. They've got all sorts of great custody products. They've pre-recorded an advertisement that I'm going to play right now, and then we'll get into the episode with Jeff. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Digital assets custody can be quite difficult to secure and hard to scale. Firms are often left with a difficult decision, having to choose between security or liquidity. At Ledger, we're obsessed that our clients' businesses succeed. That is why we decided to create a digital asset platform that would enable financial institutions and crypto firms to manage their funds without compromising on security and liquidity. Firms like Uphold, Bitstamp, Crypto.com, Index, and Dunamu are already using Ledger Vault to operate their business at scale while maintaining the highest standards of security to protect their clients' funds. Visit ledger.com/vault to learn more. Control, scalability, agility, because security is not enough.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I have Jeff here. We've got a ton to talk about. You recently wrote a book and have a bunch of really cool ideas I think that people will be interested in learning about. So thanks so much for coming on and doing this.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah. Let's go right through your background first, because you are not an author by trade. So maybe let's start there and we can then get into some of the ideas.
Yeah, good call. Yeah, a book is not something I wanted to write. I felt I had to write. So I'm a technology executive, technology co-founder of multiple companies. I've started four companies. One of those companies grew to $500 million in market cap over the course of 19 years, and just a whole bunch of technology boards. So sitting at the front seat of how technology is changing the world.
Very cool. And the book, what was kind of the genesis for why to write the book?
I looked forward in what's happening with technology and how it's bumping up against an existing system that won't work in the future. And I thought, my kids won't grow up in the same world I grew up in. The future will not look anything like the past. All of the benefits that were provided to us, I think, will be stripped away. And the world will look very different unless we get our heads around what's happening.
For sure. And so the book is called The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. Let's just start with kind of the 101. What is deflation and what is inflation?
Okay. So again, people have an emotional attachment to these. They shouldn't, right? It's just, this is the facts of it. Inflation is when your money loses value and assets go up in price as a result, right? because the purchasing power of your money goes down, so goods and services get more expensive. And deflation is the opposite. Your purchasing power goes up because goods and services get less expensive. And there's a whole bunch of an emotional context to that that actually has nothing to do with the facts, right? And so people will just blindly say deflation is bad, inflation is good, without realizing kind of, with inflation, you're actually saying, I'm destroying the value of the currency, right? That's what you were trying to, so when a government has an inflationary target, what if they said, we are going to try to essentially make the currency worthless or worth less? Would people be on the street rising up? And they might be, right? So, but it's, I think it's important to detach the emotion from the facts, and then you can debate the facts and build better systems.
So let's talk about inflation first, because that's obviously the system that we live in today, the fiat currencies and kind of the economic model. Help us understand, like, how exactly does inflation work? And then what is the reasoning behind why we have the inflationary model we have? Like what's the kind of defense of inflation?
Well, number one, and it's provided the world a lot of wealth, right? We've been in an inflationary environment for a long time. Our parents grew up in it, their parents grew up in it, and so on. And it's provided the world a lot of wealth. But in that, the assets go up in price. So if you borrow today with money, you borrow from the bank today, then with inflation, your incomes will rise over time and the money will be worth less, right? And so you pay that money back later on with inflation, with dollars that are worth less, and the asset prices rise. A good example is a house. My parents bought their first house for, I think it was $69,000, in the 70s. That house is worth $1.5 million today. The debt that was paid back, I think they took a $59,000 debt, which was a lot at that time, and they paid it back over time as their incomes rose. So that's the world we live in, and it's not bad. Some people win more, right? The debt holders win more, and everything else, and it's not bad. But we've had a structural break, and it's not COVID. The structural break is technology that has changed the rules.
Yeah. And so the current economic system we have was really built for the old world, right? And so if it was built for the old world, maybe describe a little bit about your thought process of like that industrial revolution type world is dying. And what I think you're arguing here is the fact that we need a new economic model for the world we're going into, right? It's kind of like we had an old world with an old economic system. That old economic system matched the world we were in. Now, if the world changes to this technology-enabled world, now all of a sudden you're arguing that we actually need a new economic model for the future, correct?
Correct. And if you look at this, you can see it everywhere, by the way. It's all of the evidence points to it, but people are ignoring it because they don't want to believe it. So I'll give some proof points. And so probably the best example that everybody has in their hand is their iPhone or smartphone. That phone, it was only invented 13 years ago, right? And look at the phone, what's on it today. Just about all your apps are free, right? You use Google for free, Waze for free, it's all free. So you have the power, more than presidents had 20 years ago, 30 years ago, sitting in the palm of your hands, and it's all free. You can buy, and by the way, it's not deflation bad free. We don't wait for, when the new iPhone comes up, there's a line around the block to buy it, even though you can get last year's for next to nothing on a plan of $20 a month and have everything for free. So that technology deflation is a good thing, right? Our Google searches are, in fact, all of the platform companies, from music to Google to Amazon, they're all created actually using that same example. You know technology, you're an investor in technology. I'm very much an investor in technology. And it's a good thing that every technology executive I work with is trying to do good in the world and provide more efficiency and better, more abundance using technology, and that comes at the cost of jobs. So that's what's happening overall, and it's accelerating in the world. The only thing masking that is a massive increase in debt and leverage, where you're pulling demand forward from the future with debt that you can never pay back in the future. And so that massive amount of debt and money, monetary easing in the last 20 years to get negligible inflation rates is $185 trillion to produce $46 trillion of economic return in GDP. So when debt is growing way faster than GDP, you know something's wrong, right? And here's the thing, this is before COVID. This is before everything. I predicted all of these events before they were happening. COVID accelerates the trend to technology, right? And it accelerates. Zoom went from 10 million users to 200 million users in a month. How many of those users don't need the same commercial real estate when they come back out of COVID? And so how much changes, how fast this changes, how fast robotics is changing, how fast AI is moving. People that aren't close to technology don't realize how fast this is moving. And our old systems weren't built for that technology deflation. Because if you have deflation, debt explodes in real terms. You can never pay it back. So if you have effectively economy that's built on massive debt creation and you allow deflation, you have to reset the debt. And that's a problem that central bankers all over the world are facing. They don't know what to do, right? And because the system, and so instead of facing the facts, you keep papering over the facts. And every time you paper over the facts, like if you look at the stock market rising because of you're juicing the Fed's taking anything off the balance sheets, it's not capitalism. You're picking the pockets of the poor and paying the rich because asset prices go up. And that leads to division of society, revolutions and wars, and there's a reset in that event no matter what.
Yeah, I think this is a really important part where basically people don't realize the inflation has an impact on a portion of the population, but it also benefits the other portion, right? I actually recently tweeted and said, every time that more money is printed, the rich people cheer because they know they're going to get richer, right? Because those asset prices will continue to rise over time. Whereas the bottom, 50% or so of Americans, in some cases the bottom 90%, they end up getting hurt and they don't even realize it. So it's almost like you've got one group that understands the rules of the game and the other that doesn't.
Did you read Paul Volcker's quote back a number of years ago? He said, we have a whole bunch of enormously rich people that have convinced themselves they're rich because they're smart and constructive. Right. and it's not that. It's because you've rigged the rules of the game. And by the way, I understand how hard this is from a banking policy and everything else. So let's just use a little example and you and me in our own little economy, and it will expand it. So let's say you and I went to school together. I decided to save money. You decided to come out of school and borrow money. To spend lavishly, right? You borrowed 500K, I didn't, I tried to save, right? And let's call that year 2002. your economy, what it looks like to everybody else around you, you buy a house, you hire gardeners, everything else. If you can't pay back the 500,000, then you have a real problem. But if instead of paying back the 500,000, you borrow another million 2 years later to be able to do that, and then you buy another house and everything else. You could never pay back the 500,000, but you use some of the million to be able to pay back the house, the interest, and some to buy another house. And then I, as your friend, I go and rent one of those houses. And you believe, and everyone looks at you and says, wow, look at how much success you have, right? And then you can't keep up to that. and you borrow another million, but you buy another house. And then you think, wow, I'm going to create a business around this. And you employ tons of people, and you, all that leverage is juicing returns, and the asset prices are going up the whole time. I'm waiting patiently, thinking it's all a house of cards. He can't pay for any of it. It's all going to come crashing down. And I'm waiting for the day that that it all comes crashing down, and I make my fortune with my cash when the market resets. But what happens is I misunderstand that the central banks are part of that game, right? And the banking system is part of that game. And everybody was fooled by all the jobs that your gardeners, your vacations, your boats, everything else created. And everybody copying you doing the same thing. And all of that leverage pushed up housing prices, and my rents kept going up as well, right? I'm on the other side. And it looked like it was really working. And then 2008, it comes. And banks stop lending to each other because they can't trust the balance sheets. Right, all over the world, the internet connections are global. The central bankers think it's only subprime, and it explodes everywhere. And if they don't save the system, we end up with a depression. Right, that's what would have happened in 2008, a global depression, and that would have been really bad. But the cost of saving the system saves you and everybody else who leveraged the system. And kills me because my cash is destroyed in value. It's just a transfer of wealth, and so we wonder why we have this insane amount of wealth disparity, and it's because we're gaming the system.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in that situation, then let's go to kind of the new economic model, right? So we're well aware that we're entering a new world, a technology-enabled world. In that world, if we're able to switch from inflation to deflation, what does the new world look like?
This is going to break people's brains, but again, that's why it's hard to. I think you need to detach the emotion from the facts. If you could reset today. Like imagine a total reset, you had no debt in the world and you could reset. You wouldn't need as many jobs, right? Because jobs would fall at the natural rate of technology deflation and things would get lower and lower cost over that course. And you also wouldn't need a massive social safety net to be able to protect the people that fell out because the natural course, gravity would happen, right? Instead of fighting gravity and pretending you're going to stop it, you would allow that to happen. And actually capitalism would work perfectly in that system because the people who wanted to work more would create all sorts of value and get paid more of the pie. But the people that fell off that treadmill because jobs are coming out of society with robotics, AI, everything else, people that wouldn't fall and not be able to feed their families.
Right, because their savings would basically be getting more valuable.
Exactly, you're not distorting capitalism. You're not. Mm-hmm. Think about this right now because all that happened in 2008 forward now is we papered over the problem. We created a way bigger problem, right? And now COVID exposed that. So the system is so much more fragile now, and so you have. Governments, and I talked about this in the book. Remember, I talked about this in the book before this happened, right? Because it's predictable no matter what. There's nothing central governments around the world are going to be able to do to stop technological deflation. Nothing. It's a structural difference. And it's like, I use this example quite often. It's like Blockbuster, 9,000 stores, not seeing Netflix because technology was moving so fast and didn't see that the rate of speed of download speed would change their economic model overnight. And instead of buying Netflix for $50 million, they added candy aisles to their Blockbuster stores, right? And if you zoom up to what we're doing, what central banks all over the world are doing, we're adding candy aisles to the Blockbuster stores, right? And think about this. So you have, you're juicing return, because if you actually wrote down the assets, and this is an important policy decision too, right? And so it's not good, bad people. There's a whole bunch of people in Twitter land and everything else and saying all these terrible people. If you're in their shoes and you look out and you see we have a global depression coming, or we can try to keep this going, this deck chairs on the Titanic going, you might do the same thing, right? So the policy response right now is they're not looking at the second order and third order consequences of the policy decisions. They're looking at right now, what do I do with facing this unemployment rate and everything else? But by throwing money, so to yesterday, the Fed announced the $2.3 trillion in essentially junk bonds, right? and that would look like subprime. That would have got, the whole thing would have gone to zero. And so the Fed took that off the balance sheet of people that created the problem and replaced fresh cash. The result of that means the asset prices don't fall like they need to, right? So as asset prices are automatically juiced and they stay high and they'll go higher because you're destroying the currency underneath. And then a whole bunch of people left out of society, you have to pay them too to be able to pay for those high asset prices and rent. And so the amount of wasted money, staggering on both sides of this equation, and you're driving this divide, socialism, capitalism, and both people are talking about the system, the old system, and all the solutions on top of it are old solutions on top of it because they don't know that it's a structural change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of this is people don't understand how the system works, obviously. But what you're talking about here is in this deflationary environment, there's two things that I think are really important. So the first is this idea that right now we ask American citizens and citizens around the world, be an expert at what you do for a living. So whether you're a teacher, a fireman, investor, you know, whatever it is you do for a professional living, you've got to be a professional at it, right? You've got to be one of the best. Then we also say, by the way, you can't just make money and hold on to that money because ultimately that money will lose value over time. We're going to incentivize you to either spend it or invest it. Right. And so you can spend it, right? You can be a consumer and consume more. Or we then say to you, you either have to become a professional investor as well, or you're going to have to pay somebody who is a professional to invest the money for you. And so what ends up occurring here is the idea of saving actually isn't nearly as valuable as it should be, right? Right. You're basically saving something that's just leaking through the holes in a bucket to some degree. Right. And so when you move to a deflationary environment, what you can actually say to somebody is the money that you are paid, if you save it, over time, you will become wealthier. You will be rewarded for having a low time preference and for saving rather than be incentivized to either become a professional investor or pay somebody to invest your capital. And I think that just that alone changes the way that wealth is distributed throughout the world simply by taking the bottom 50% and structurally putting them at an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
Yeah, exactly. And capitalism works perfectly in that system, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. So today, instead of thinking of it as money, think about it as I put a pizza in the bank, right, so I can eat. And I go back to and it's in four slices and I can eat for 4 days. And then I go back to the bank and it's in six slices, right? I'm still hungry, right? I got my pizza, but it doesn't feed me the same. I got what they said, but they divided it, and it doesn't feed me the same. And so, if you think about what's happening in our economies, right, that's what's happening in our economies. And so, no wonder people are rising up. No wonder the bottom half is looking at things we didn't see. We haven't seen since the 30s, right? 20s and 30s, socialism and how rampant that whole, because the system right now doesn't work.
Yeah. Let's talk about the transition period between the inflation to deflation, right? So we kind of understand how the existing system works. We understand here's a world that could work better. The transition is, I think, the part that scares the shit out of most people,
yeah,
right?
And it should. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what, in your opinion, like, how does that transition most likely happen? And then what is the good parts of the transition? And then what are the scary bad parts of it?
So a cleansing of the system is required, right? That cleansing of the system is going to happen one way or the other. That's, if we keep doing what we're doing, currencies are going to break, because now it's just game theory and global currencies and everybody's printing more. So if every currency is printing more, you've ruined trust of what a fundamental unit of value is. And if you can't trust that trade, trade collapses. And that's a huge problem, but that's a small problem. The bigger problem of that is politicians get elected with that and blame other people for creating the problem, which creates revolution and war. Right? You can see that in the US political cycle today. You can see it around the world, and it's all caused from the same thing. It's people want to believe somebody, and they'll believe anybody. It's easier to say it's his fault rather than to say it's a structural problem. It's easier to blame somebody. It's easier to blame China. It's easier to blame somebody else. And then as that starts to happen, and you have to create a bigger enemy is effectively mm-hmm. what that looks like. And so if you keep doing what we're doing, that's what you can expect, revolutions and wars to be commonplace, really ugly. And you'll have politicians that take the bottom 50% and say it's not your fault, it's their fault. And when that divide becomes too much, those assets will get taken anyways, right? Mm-hmm. It won't look, so the rich in that case are deluding themselves if it can go on, because there'll be pitchforks in the street, and then that'll move from country to country. That's it, what the existing system looks like. If you allowed deflation to happen, if you just said full stop, and so one argument, that's a bad outcome, right? The other argument is potentially just as bad an outcome, and let capitalism work and stop propping up banks, everything else, and let the system fail and reset. You would go through a world global multi-year depression, right? And there would be a lot of unemployment. There would be a lot of problems in that. So because the problem is now so big, the solution there isn't. I would love to say there's a really easy solution and here's what it is. I can't say that right now, and nobody can. And the people that are saying that are deluding themselves, right? They're not looking at this from a first principle standpoint, or looking at the second order and third order consequences of the decision. But those are the facts where we are.
And so I guess in that environment, so if you go with the first one where there's the wars, the revolutions, et cetera, it's not so much one country versus another. It's basically the people versus the establishment, right?
But the problem is it turns into, look at the rise of Hitler in the 30s, right? It was a fringe party that came into power because there were bread lines in the streets, right? And that happened because US called their debt, right? And they had to go into this hyperinflation environment to get out of the debt. So they had to print money like crazy to get out of the debt. And that forced people in the street with no jobs, and they couldn't feed themselves. And in that environment, people rise up and say, it's not your fault. It's these people that have the money. It's their fault. And when you've done that, and that's not a big enough thing to retain power, you have to create a bigger enemy outside your country. So you're right. The first order consequence is rising up in the streets, right? Inside countries. Second order consequence is that's not a big enough enemy to retain power. And so you have to, it's really predictable, right? We've seen it throughout history. Anytime you get into this currency battles, this is what is a likely outcome. And it doesn't need to look like that. But there needs to be very critical debate on the first principles, on what's changed, to be able to avoid that outcome.
And I guess then if you go to the second option, which is let the system fail, right? Let the bad companies get flushed out, et cetera. Is the argument that they won't do that because of the short-term pain?
That's the argument. The short-term pain. Name a politician that does the long-term good, right? It's really difficult to play a long-term bet against how much short-term pain. So that's actually what. And I know you're a fan of Bitcoin. I am as well. I hope I don't need it, right? I really hope I don't need it, but all of the data is supporting that I'm going to, right? Because if I need it, what that means is currencies have failed everywhere and it becomes a new standard and we have a harsh reset and it explodes in value. Yes, it creates a lot of wealth for people that know that early, that are the tons of wealth, but the reset is so severe in the world that it also creates staggering pain.
Right. Yeah. And I guess as part of that, is Bitcoin the only answer, or is there something like gold, right? That's just kind of more sound money, or maybe there's something else. Like what do you think the potential solutions or options are?
So as a policy response right now, and I'm involved in this in Canada, but you saw the same thing Tim Cook said. The best policy response right now would be, where are the jobs in the future going to be? If you're an individual country or state or anything else, where are the jobs going to be? And double down there. Instead of propping up the existing system, right? Make a huge bet on where the jobs are going to be in the future. That bet is technology, right? And so technology is going to accelerate from here, and that is where the jobs are going to be, but it won't create enough jobs to replace the one that they're destroying. That's kind of the point. So if you're playing game theory and doing what you could do for one economy, double, triple, quadruple down on technology, because you built, they used to build roads, right? The roads are now technology lanes, right? the backbone of our world is a technology landscape. And that's where the investment should be going. For the countries that do that, they'll come out stronger. But if every country does that, which is likely, it's pretty predictable. If a bunch of countries did that, then everybody's competing for the same scarce technology jobs, and you're going to have deflation anyways, like no matter what. So that would be the policy response that could actually probably make at least the money that you spend. Make a bigger difference to your economy, and then you wouldn't naturally prop up prices that should fall, and it would transition slowly. You're still with the amount of debt in the world, there's the amount of debt in any economy, you're going to still have to reset that debt at some point, and that reset, a lot of people are going to be wiped out, right? A lot of people that think debt can be paid forever by increasing more debt, those people are going to be wiped out.
What happens to governments, meaning the national debt and things like that, where it's not on the individual level or kind of the individual corporate level, it's actually on a more macro scale, something like the U.S. government's debt?
Well, that is the same thing. So that's why I say the game right now is in currencies, right? And so it's moved from, the debt went from technology companies, .com boom, to housing, to asset bubble after asset bubble after asset bubble. And that wasn't enough. And each time you needed more debt to replace the problem created before, because the structure has changed, right? And now it's just moved to currencies. So that's actually why Bitcoin is a logical progression, because what is a currency? It's a piece of paper with faces on it. If you lend me a whole bunch of money, right, and I can't pay you back, but I have a little magic printing machine that I can change the nominal value of that currency and pretend to pay you back, you probably wouldn't do that again. You probably wouldn't lend me again, right? And so that's what's happening in governments all over the world. you're starting to get that critical point where how many zeros can you add to this thing and still trust the foundation of currency? And you can't.
Yeah. I recently wrote something where I basically said, the magician has been exposed, right? Yeah. And it's this idea of like, the entire economy is built on the fact that 50% or more of the participants in the economy don't understand how money works. Because if they did, right, it's the Henry Ford quote, if they understood how it worked, they'd be revolting in the streets by tomorrow.
Right.
And so I think what is happening right now, and I'm still kind of thinking through it, so don't hold me exactly to this, but it feels like the Federal Reserve is having to explain the magic trick to the national audience. And what's interesting to me is you've got, 16 million Americans, give or take, who have lost their job in the last 3 weeks. Add that up with the 5.8 million that were already previously unemployed. So you got about 21, 22 million Americans that are sitting at home, no jobs, should be in the labor force. There's no sports on television, right? And so all they can do is they can basically play on social media. They can watch Netflix, or they can pay attention to COVID-19 and economic news. Right.
And you're probably busy as a result.
Yeah. And it's just not that much going on. Right. And so this is kind of like prime time television is what's going on in the economy and with the virus. And so right at that moment when everyone's paying attention and also everyone's fearful, you then get the Federal Reserve saying we have unlimited money. We can just print the money. Right. We're going to print $2 trillion here, $2 trillion here. Here's another trillion, et cetera. And what I think happens is all of a sudden you're giving a crash course in what money is and how it works to the bottom 50% that you never wanted to understand how money works, right? You were counting on them not to know it, but now you've revealed the magic trick to them. And so the question that I think will come out of this is something like, wait a second, you can make as much money as you want out of thin air. Why do I pay you taxes if you can just create the money anyways, right? And you start to get more of these like populist type questions where people start to just say, this doesn't make sense to me. Right. And I think that's kind of step one of many, many steps that eventually end up in social unrest. But it, it's not immediate. But I do think that it all starts with kind of revealing the magic trick and having to do it on a national stage and transparent because you're trying to solve the short term problems.
Yeah. And I don't know even so. So if you looked at primetime TV, do you think anybody really understands the magic trick?
I don't think that there's any explanation of it. What I think ends up happening is people see, wait a minute, where'd $2 trillion come from? Right. And they're almost like, it's like being the difference between going to a college and sitting there and somebody saying, okay, pull out the textbook and we're going to teach you, line by line, exactly how this is theoretically supposed to work versus somebody says, hey, you want to be a fireman? Run into that fire. Right. And either you figure out how to fight the fire or you die. And over time, what ends up happening is the people who just learn by doing, that's essentially what's happening here, right? Is you're learning by seeing it actually happen. And so not everyone gets educated, but I think more people are educated watching this than probably, previously by just going to school or something like that.
Maybe. And that's why shows like what you do is so important right now, because it breaks through the clutter that people are talking about and gives some light to some of the first principles, what's really happening behind the magic curtain.
Yeah. What do you think the TV coverage that we're seeing right now, good, bad, everywhere in between?
I try not to tune in and watch because I find it's all done for sound bites and for and it's short term and everything else. I don't think the right thing to do is say, what would you have us do, right? And still make the wrong decision, right? So I understand the problem, right? I totally understand the problem. I understand where governments have created so much money and they've kicked the can down the road. Now, remember Nassim Taleb's quote that sometimes preventing the forest fire creates a bigger fire on the horizon because you don't clear the bush and the dead bush, so the next fire is way bigger. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing, right? And so that is not solving a problem. That is making future generations pay for a problem that is exponentially bigger. Mm-hmm. So what you have right now, and actually, if you looked at the numbers, it's crazy. You have technology moving exponentially, right? And and you know this, but technology runs on Moore's law, which is an exponential pattern. And even if Moore's law ends in a number of cycles, quantum computers, the digitization, AI is moving so fast, you could assume we're going to have an exponential pattern in technology for a long time to come. Why that matters a lot, I use this to quote before, but if you fold a piece of paper 50 times on itself, at fold 50, I've asked this to tens of thousands of people, and most people would say fold 50, it'll be 2 inches thick. At fold 50, if you could, you can only fold it 7 times on itself, but at fold 50, the piece of paper would be from here to the sun. And what you just did with your face is, I've seen that tens of thousands of times, and it's just an exponential pattern. And it's not I'm smarter. The first time I saw that, I thought, there's no way it goes to the sun. I had to Google it to see it. All human beings miss exponential patterns. Mm-hmm. We're bad at it, everybody. Otherwise, you'd have way more guesses that went to the sun, right? if you looked at the data. So we all are bad at exponential patterns, but we have an exponential pattern underneath technology that's doubling at that rate. And we're looking backwards in time of technology and making predictions on a linear scale looking forwards. And what's happening right now in technology, we're in the steep steps, right? So name a technology company or name a technology industry, and what ends up happening in the early folds, you have this hype cycle. They call it the Gartner hype cycle, right? You have this hype cycle because people overestimate the impact, the benefit, and it rises, tons of money goes into that, and then it collapses, but it keeps doubling. And so what ends up happening is, on the first fold of a piece of paper, it looks like nothing. And so somebody tells you it's going to, on the second fold, it's going to be great. Second fold, it looks like nothing. We're on fold 33 right now, if you take those analogs together. Fold 34 doubles the last 50 years. And if you now compare that to the debt creation, it's a mirror image. The amount of debt to try to pretend we live in the old world is rising exactly lockstep to the amount of technology deflation that's happening. Mm-hmm. And if you add in the unfunded liabilities, social safety net, pensions, everything else in the black pool, everything else, you would see it really clearly. And if that wasn't bad enough, right? So to prove the point that the old system won't work anymore, that's looking backwards. Looking forwards, that's kind of what I put in the book, and a lot of people are talking about right now. This was perfectly predictable, right? Perfectly predictable, because the amount of debt needed right now to pretend we still live in the old world is so crazy. It's so much more than even the wildest predictions on Twitter are saying. And so at some point that breaks.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a world where they recognize this and they just let it break? They let the defaults happen and they let the cleansing? Or is it just, it's impossible for them to do that because of the game theory?
Now we're playing with probabilities. So it's hard to say. So the next number of years is going to look very different. It's going to break anyways, no matter what. If there was a global coordinated effort to say, we're going to write off some of this, a whole pile of this debt, write it to zero, a whole bunch of people fail, and we're going to have a new standard like Bretton Woods, where we can trust money again globally, Bitcoin wouldn't survive in that. You could create a digital Bitcoin that was backed by all current currencies that could actually replace trust. That would be, and by the way, I'm personally long on Bitcoin, so that would not be, that might not be a good thing for that value, right? But I don't think that could happen in today's trust environment.
Yeah, it's almost like the things that they would need to do in order to be successful, there's just no way they'll do it because it would involve such incredible global coordination among countries that just don't get along.
In a world that the lack of trust is actually coming from the same thing that we talked about before, the lack of trust when every country needs to manipulate their currency to drive the global jobs agenda, right? Then there's a total lack of trust in currencies. And to try to come back together and say we're going to fix that globally right now, I don't think there's a chance. That would play into why I'm really long on Bitcoin, because it's going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, it almost feels like there's this element of you get one of two options, right, to solve the problem. The first option would be global coordination where everyone trusts each other. We come together, we create a new standard, we write off the old debt, and we move forward under, you know, Bretton Woods 2, right, yeah, or whatever you want to call it. But that involves complete trust of everyone at the table to coordinate and agree together. The other option is trust no one, right? Sure. Which essentially is what Bitcoin is. And the trust no one option means there's going to be no one in control. There's going to be no one in charge. And you actually don't need to trust anyone else because you have the full transparency to verify, blocks, et cetera. And so you either get 100% trust or you get 100%, no trust. And I think you're probably in the same camp as I, of like, I just don't see the world where everyone comes together and coordinates. And therefore that would suggest then you end up in a world where trust no one ends up being the dominant kind of approach.
Yeah. And if you play that forward, so game theory predicts that the sum of everyone is better when people cooperate. Right. But what ends up happening is everyone cooperating creates an incentive for somebody to cheat, right? And so so if you look at that through Bretton Woods or anything else, even changing the gold reserve off the, so everyone cooperated, world's in a great place, and then US can't pay Vietnam wars and everything else off the gold standard, and causing people not to cooperate as much. For a while, that fiat currency backed all other world currencies, or 80% of world currencies, and it looked like it was going, but you started manipulating. At which point, every other currency has to manipulate too. The yuan has to manipulate to drive their jobs, euro does, every other currency. So, and that problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So if you look through game theory, what ends up happening is you have cooperation, and then no cooperation, and then cooperation again, and no cooperation through a lens of the world. It's a simple example would be driving in the carpool lane, right? If the carpool lane is only used for people who carpool, it works really well for people who carpool. If a lot of people cheat, then incentive accrues to those people who cheat. And then if nobody catches those people that cheat, everybody cheats, then there's no carpool advantage, right? So looking through this whole thing through that lens, and countries and currencies and everything else, is a really important thing. But I would totally agree with you. I cannot see. It's a small possibility, but it's improbable that governments today, this far away from cooperation, could come together and cooperate on a global scale that needs to happen to be able to prevent kind of a reset.
Yeah. So it's a pretty crazy world we're living in. What's the one thing that would change your mind? Like, is there something that could happen that could change your mind about needing to move into the deflationary world?
I don't think so. So if technology is deflationary, and that's not, and when I say if, it is clearly deflationary, right? That's not a guess, it's a fact. And if technology is moving into every industry, then there's no possible way that we can run an inflationary world anymore without jerry-rigging a system. And that's what we're seeing, right? That's why I say that it's way more important. Let's just talk about the changes that have happened, and rebuild a society that works better for everybody using what the facts are clearly pointing out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, because I think that there's the structural challenges, right? Obviously, which you've outlaid in terms of where we are, why it's unsustainable. And then it's very clear as to where we need to go. The big question mark, I think, is that transition period, right?
Agreed.
Yeah, and on the transition period, I just don't see one where there's no social unrest, right? I don't see like an orderly transition. And that's the part that I think a lot of people are just like, how do we do that? And the answers they keep coming to make them uncomfortable.
Yeah. So, and I think that's, but that is the truth, right? So if deflation is in our future, if what I said, have people look deeper, read the book, debate that fact and everything else, and prove me wrong on that. I can't see any world where that isn't true, but I'm happy to debate that fact. The other thing is, it's just starting. It's going to get way worse. The technology. If you think about how many people that are working from home now will stay working from home, right? Think about what that looks like. Think about the acceleration to digital that's happening right now out of COVID, and how that accelerates retail store closures, how that accelerates a whole pile of industries, commercial real estate that might not be need to price where it is because it's not needed as much. So it's all over the place in every part of society. But if that's a fact, and I think it's a pretty clear fact, then let's talk about what the solution looks like in that. Because if you need to protect people's wages, and you don't need to juice those people's wages to protect a staggering amount of debt that you created in the first place, right? If you don't need to pay them more to keep up with the treadmill that you put them on in the first place, right? Wouldn't that be a good thing? So next year, instead of your Mars bar costing $1, it costs 90 cents, and the year after that, 80 cents, and everything else, and you're following. Isn't that a good thing for society? There's this misconception about economics, and people put their head in the sand with economics because they think it's too complicated. And here's the thing. A lot of the economists make it too complicated, trying to explain things that just clearly aren't there, and that scares people from asking the first principle type of questions. Economics isn't about value; it's about scarcity. Right, the air you breathe is the most important thing in your life right now. You don't pay for it. You pay for it if you go diving underwater where air is scarce. You might pay for it in Vegas where if there's lots of smoke in the air or if the air is polluted, but you don't pay for your air because it's abundant and free. And you can't create economic models about where there's abundance. Technology creates abundance everywhere, right? And that's a good thing for society. We should be celebrating.
Yeah, it's this crazy thing where there's a separation between what sounds to be the right, sane, kind of prudent thing, and the thing that everyone's drunk and addicted to, right? And that's ultimately what it ends up coming down to.
Yeah, that's you said it perfectly. It's a hit of cocaine, right? And you need a bigger hit every time to think. Eventually the patient dies.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I always do rapid fire questions. What's your most controversial thought in either technology or finance?
Yeah, controversial in finance is this one, that in technology, AI is going to effectively the speed and rate of growth of AI. AI is going to be smarter than all of us, more creative, more everything else. It's logical, a pattern. Every single job is a function of intelligence. So how could you get more jobs if AI is going to be smarter than all of us.
How long does that take?
Low case, the top researchers are saying 5 years. I think it's going to be longer, 40 years. But that whole trend across that landscape is all going to be deflationary, right? Because it's going to be more and more and more the entire time, exponentially more the entire time. But say it's 100 years, it doesn't matter, right? The time frame. So if that is going to happen, which it's going to happen, then we have to rebuild society to forward anyways.
Yeah. What's the best book you've ever read, other than your own, obviously?
I love Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. Just because it forces you to, I made a whole bunch of mistakes in reading the book. They take you through and it forces you to realize to ask questions that you might not have asked yourself before and kind of find blind spots in your own critical thinking.
Yeah, this Daniel Pink, I believe, right?
Yeah, Daniel Kahneman.
Daniel Kahneman. Okay, got it. Very cool. Believer in aliens? Yes. No. No.
So it would say, do I believe in other? Maybe, do I believe in life on other worlds? Yes, I guess so. Yeah, it'd be hard to say on how many worlds to say no.
What is the logic for believing that there is other life? I'm with you. I just wonder what the logic is.
The amount of planets and solar and stars in our solar system. It's just illogical to think that there isn't life somewhere else. Yeah. So when you first said aliens, I was thinking about people visiting Earth.
Yeah. Well, so I've asked this question to 260, 270 people, whatever it's been now, and over 95% of people say yes. I believe in something being out there, etc., which is a much higher percentage than I would have guessed before I started asking everyone that question.
Yeah. You ask a whole bunch of people that look at probability distributions and if you looked at the probabilities with that many planets, it'd be impossible to say no.
Exactly. What one question do you have for me to finish up?
More of not a question, more of a statement. Keep doing what you're doing. Like this it means a lot right now. It's really, really important work. I didn't write the book. I don't need a book sale I didn't write the book for any reason somebody like you with what you're doing makes a huge difference can make a huge difference to what's happening. So thanks.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. As I tell people, what started out as me doing a bunch of learning has now turned into, there's a sense of responsibility to some degree, right. To kind of continue to share what I think and I'm learning. So it's a weird world we're living in, because I don't think I ever expected to be in this position, but here we are. As I'm sure you didn't expect to write a book at some point, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. All right. Well, guys, I hope that you guys enjoyed this. Please go get the book, The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to the Abundant Future. Obviously, there's a number of really important ideas in there, and I think that Jeff's done a great job. So I appreciate you jumping on here, and we'll have to do it again as that world becomes more of a reality.
Awesome. Thanks.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.